Welcome to the Red Phone Zone. This is issue number 56. I am a host, Aaron.
And I am a host, Ethan.
Well, last week we had a genuine IMDb entry holder on our show. And actually, this week we do as well, too.
Yes.
We have an award-winning writer on today.
Yes, we do.
Who is this writer that we have on tonight, Ethan?
We have got Razzie Award winner...
Oh, man! Seriously?
John Rogers.
Oh, adorable.
Seriously, though, we got John Rogers on here, who is not only one of the guys who did one of our favorite comics, Blue Beetle, the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle, but also one of the brains behind the hit TNT show Leverage. So, amongst many, many, many other accolades and works that he's been involved in. So, say hi to the people, John.
Hi, people. Thanks for tuning in, despite my sucky resume.
Hey, we didn't say that you suck. We just said that you're an award winner. I don't have any awards for being good or bad.
No. And, so last week, of course, we had on Monty Cook, who has his one little...
Dorkness Rising
credit. And now we've got John Rogers, who has a genuine...
pictures and everything.
With pictures and everything, IMDb page. So we feel special.
We do feel special.
Didn't you have Matt Forbeck on a while ago? Matt's on the IMDb, isn't he?
Whoa.
We did have Matt on.
Yes, he that's right. He worked on the script for Mutant Chronicles, among other things.
Yeah.
Didn't he?
Yeah.
That's right.
So he worked on the story for Transformers.
And you got to give the prop to Jackie Chan Adventures.
Yeah, you got to love the Jackie Chan Adventures.
Ironically, of all the stuff I've done, I think Jackie Chan Adventures will have the longest legacy. It just hit, like, animation and American TV at the right time.
Yep.
And 9 out of 10 times, that's what somebody asks or talks about when I meet them and they know my resume.
Sure. And, well, Leverage is getting up there. I mean, Leverage has just hit the... Did you just finish up or are you just starting the fourth season?
We're filming the fourth season now. The fourth season premiere is actually June 26th.
That's right. Excellent.
Fantastic. I was a fan of Cosby. And I know it's Cosby, the thing that was on the late 90s, not the Cosby show. I liked that show.
It was based on a really interesting British show. The tragedy of it is Dougie Doug was really doing like Emmy quality work. And it just kind of got eaten by the fact that the show
didn't know what it wanted to be.
Bill didn't necessarily want to be on TV anymore, and just, you know, it was a mess. But we did some okay stuff.
Yeah, I mean, am I thinking right? Was Madeline Kahn in that?
Eddie was on it. Yeah,
and that was when she passed away, right? Because it seems like I remember. Yeah, I remember
she passed away while she was with us.
Yeah, it seemed like I remember a tribute episode, but yeah, well, that's
too
bad.
We did, and she was so great. She was really just a gift. I mean, that was one of the cool things is I can't believe I'm talking to Madeline Kahn. You know, that was one of the neat things about being on the set.
Yeah, that would...
Although, first time I met Phil, I froze up. Phil.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, oh, yeah, Phil Cosby.
I was actually talking about, I was on set, it was literally my first job in television, and they had missed the production thing that I was trying to explain to them what was wrong on set. So, it's just one of those stupid things where all of a sudden you're surrounded by executives and you're 30 years old and you're totally out of your league, but you're the only one who knows that something's about to go horribly wrong. And suddenly I hear, like, what is going on? And it was like hearing Bugs Bunny talk. It's like, wow, like an actual cartoon character is real and walking over to me. It was an interesting time.
Excellent. Well, we want to thank you for being on the show.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's a real pleasure.
This is going to be a good show. Actually, tonight what we're going to be talking about is the film genre of film noir. I've been looking forward to the show for a while. We do these every week, and we talk about genres, you know, that I have, you know, I have varying interest in, but I love this genre. This is a fantastic genre. But before we get into that stuff, we have a segment we like to call Geekly Happenings. It's when we talk about news that we find that's relevant to us geeks.
Mm-hmm. Or at least I find relevant to us geeks.
Ethan finds relevant, and I react to it, so... Come on, give me something to react to, Ethan.
Oh, first one I've got is, as we all know, there's a Lone Ranger movie that's in development coming out. I don't think it started filming yet quite, but it's Gore Verbinski.
Right.
He's going to do it. But the film release has been set for a December 21st, 2012 release, putting it up against The Hobbit.
Yeah.
An Unexpected Journey is also The Life of Pi, and they're also rumoring that Zack Snyder's Man of Steel is also going to come out in December. And now, for those of you who don't know, this is what the blurb is. It's sort of Don Quixote told from Sancho Panza's point of view, Verbinski told ComingSoon.net of the film's plot earlier this year. So Armie Hammer is going to play... is going to play the Lone Ranger, and Johnny Depp is attached as Tonto.
Now, is Armie Hammer confirmed?
Yes.
Is he?
That's what the article is claiming.
Last I heard, he was in talks, but yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I like the show. I mean, Gore Verbinski's a capable director. Johnny Depp's always a pleasure, so we'll see.
As is apropos with our guest, who is mainly a writer, we've got a lot of writing stuff has been announced. The writers of the upcoming Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol have been hired to write or rewrite, really, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles reboot that they're working on. Josh Applebaum and Andrew Nemec have come aboard the project for a rewrite. Previously, the Iron Man writers Art Markham and Matt Holloway were assigned to the draft of the project. It's unknown whether or not Applebaum and Nemec are going to perform a page one rewrite, or if they will just do an update of the draft. But so that's some interesting stuff. One, obviously, we're getting a reboot of TMNT.
Film or the TV show?
The film.
Cool.
They're doing a new movie.
Another one, huh?
And writer Brad Caleb Kane is going to do a new draft of Daredevil for 20th Century Fox. He's moving steadily forward with a reboot of David Slade, who did Hard Candy, 30 Days of Night, and Twilight Saga Eclipse.
Right.
Is attached to direct. Hollywood Reporter saying that the studio has brought aboard Brad Caleb Kane, a relative newcomer. As a writer on Crash and Fringe, the television series Crash and Fringe. Is also bizarrely also known for the singing voice of the title character in Disney's 1992 Aladdin.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
I think I read that somewhere.
The article suggests that Kane is going to adapt Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli's Born Again storyline, which ran in Daredevil 227 to 233 in 1986. So I'm not really familiar with
that. What year was that in?
97?
The Born Again storylines, 1986 is what the article's saying.
Wow, so. I feel old. Wow. Yeah.
I thought that they adapted that for the first one. Well, for the Ben Affleck thing.
No, Born Again is post Elektra's death.
Okay.
All right.
So, I don't know.
See, neither of us are big Daredevil experts, I'm afraid. So
Neither am I, but that was pretty seminal period of time during it.
Before Frank Miller seemingly lost his mind.
Yeah.
Another writer, Disney has hired a writer for a Tron Legacy sequel. They've hired hired David DiGilio to pen the next entry. His roots began with Disney, wrote the 2006 film Eight Below.
That movie made me cry.
With a visual blueprint of the world of Tron already created, Disney says that the studio will be able to keep the production costs down on this one. So
I want this movie to come out in 30 years. I want this.
Yeah, I really don't want to do a sequel to Legacy. I like Legacy just as it is, really.
Yeah, I think we talked about it when we reviewed Legacy. It's just like, you know, those movies are just great snapshots of the technology of films at the time.
Right.
It just like coming out with one of those this soon afterwards. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it could be great, I guess, but I doubt it.
I mean, if you were going to take some sort of, you know, all of a sudden you got like Charlie Strauss or Cory Doctorow or something to come in and kind of pitch the really extreme edge of what they're implying with that technology, that would be worth exploring, because there was some interesting ideas about post-humanism and stuff in there. But I don't know if we need to treat this like Game of Thrones, where I need to see more of the intrigue of Tron World, you know?
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, I really enjoy the original Tron. I enjoy I enjoyed Legacy just fine. I felt that the fact that they were 30 years apart sort of really did them well, and
did them.
I don't want
justice.
Them to start just churning out sort of like how they did with Pirates of the Caribbean, start churning out movies, you know.
Yeah.
I just don't want to see that.
Well, anymore. I mean, Tron Legacy did well, but it didn't do exceptionally well, did it?
I think it did.
You gotta look at international for those movies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big mistake. I find a lot of the podcasts and sort of blog-based film analyses do is they only look at domestic.
Yeah.
And really, right now, all the major studios consider the American market cake.
Right.
That's the dessert.
Well, you also have to factor in like DVD release is also a huge element, too.
Actually, DVD releases have really fallen off.
Really?
Yeah, they're not considered a really viable, particularly in television, less so in film.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it's important, but it is no longer the giant money factory it used to be.
All right. Well, there we go. Speaking of money factory,
as someone who's desperately trying to make a living in that industry, yes, that's all. I'll tell you exactly what the money
worldwide is. made a little less than $400 million.
Yep,
that's enough to make another one.
Well, yeah. They had a production budget of $200 million. Maybe that's why they're actually talking about the budget.
Then. And it made an additional $21 million in DVD sales, apparently. So.
Yeah, well, that's not.
Yeah, what was it all in? What did it make all in American markets also?
That's worldwide.
That's worldwide.
Worldwide, $100 million.
Yeah,
about 300 something here, 280 something overseas. Yeah,
172 U.S., 225 international, with 21 on DVD sales. So. $397 million is the worldwide gross with the $200 million budget. I mean, that's money.
Double their money.
But you know, it's
that also doesn't factor in marketing and all that crazy stuff. But
yeah, but P&A is really soft dollars. I mean, they write marketing out across all the films of the slate of that year.
Yeah,
and the really profitable ones actually wind up having that money written against them. So if you have a profitable movie, one of the ways the studio will keep from paying you your percentage is by shifting the marketing costs for other movies onto it.
Cool. Oh,
wow. Fascinating.
I didn't know that at all.
This is why we call it Hollywood accounting. This is why.
Awesome.
You know, this is how the studios keep from having to ever pay first dollar gross. This is basically stuff that would be illegal in any other industry.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, one of Aaron's favorite movies of all time is King Kong, and apparently 20th Century Fox is developing an animated take on the 1933 classic King Kong.
There's a King Kong cartoon already.
Well, it's said to be a modern retelling of the Beauty and the Beast tale told from Kong's point of view.
Oh, crud.
Christian Magalhaes and Robert Snow, who previously teamed for a short entitled Bunny, directed by Snow, are attached to draft the project with Sean Levy's company 21 Laps. Mark Weber, who holds the story credit, is also producing. So we may see an animated King Kong movie in the future, maybe, possibly. But
wasn't the Peter Jackson one kind of animated, more or less?
Well, yeah, pretty much. since Justin Lin seems to be involved with everything nowadays, first of all, Universal and Justice and Justin Lin are doing some sort of a sci-fi crime thriller exclusive that Universal Pictures has bought an untitled sci-fi crime thriller project script from Bobby Glickert with Fast Five director Justin Lin and Scott Stuber producing. Glickert was a production assistant on Transformers and Iron Man before becoming Lin's assistant on Fast and Furious and directing a couple short films. Although the details are kept under wraps, it's been said that it's a cross between a Michael Mann crime thriller like Heat and a Jason Bourne movie. And it's being set up as Glickert's feature film directorial debut. So that'll be something to watch, I suppose.
I guess.
While it was many, many fans out there hated and loathed and despised the G.I. Joe movie, I found it relatively entertaining. And obviously they're making a second one.
Kinda.
With John Chu, you know, from...
Yeah.
Who's hit, the Justin Bieber movie.
Mm-hmm.
Always makes him, you know, great for action right there.
Dwayne
Johnson is
attached
to it now, possibly as Roadblock, but that hasn't been officially
announced. I also read possibly Shipwreck.
Yeah. Okay. I just get an image of Dwayne Johnson in a sailor outfit. And
I think
and
it's funny.
You know.
Give him a parrot on his shoulder.
So, Johnson apparently tweeted out saying, we know what you want, and knowing is half the battle, it's on. And then got some confirmation out there that he is attached to it. So, based on various things.
I don't care. I mean, I think we talked about this movie, like, at least like what's leaked out about it so far. It's got like nobody's returning to it hardly. And, Like I think it's that Cobra Commander isn't going to be in it. Yeah, Destro isn't going to be in
what
it.
What I read is only Snake Eyes is the character that's coming back.
Yeah, Snake Eyes and maybe Storm Shadow. I don't even remember.
But yeah, I think you're right.
I think it was just the ninjas, but it's just like, that's not really a sequel.
And my last bit of big news is Eliza Dushku is going to be in a Torchwood spinoff series. She's going to be signed to star in an online animated motion comic series based on the new Torchwood Miracle Day coming from Starz. It's titled Torchwood Web of Lies, and she'll be front and center in the short film story, which will also have voice appearances by John Barrowman as Captain Jack, Eve Miles as Gwen Cooper, etc. The new series is going to be made up of 10 episodes, each 3 minutes long, with the first installment launching before Miracle Day premieres and the others going online after each subsequent episode airs.
Yeah, I read that too. I saw that. Mm-hmm. I was just like, I wonder if Ethan knows about that. You're not really into motion comics, at least not yet.
Some are good, some are not so good.
Well, I mean, content, you know.
With X-Men First Class in theaters right now, Michael Fassbender is sort of out in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. But apparently he has officially joined Tarantino's new project, Django Unchained, or Django. I don't know how you want to pronounce that.
Followed up by
another rumor that Leonardo DiCaprio is in talks to play the villain.
Cool.
the villain, Calvin Candy.
Right on.
We were just talking some James Bond about 2 weeks ago with Matt Forbeck. And the Bond 23 release date, movie still doesn't have a title, but its release date is going to be November 9th, 2012. And there's strong inklings that Naomi Harris is going to be the Bond girl in it.
Yeah, so, Calypso from the Pirates movies, right?
I believe so, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And a couple new trailers hit during this last week that at least I spotted. There was a new trailer for Fright Night featuring more of David Tennant, and I dig David Tennant.
David Tennant's pretty cool.
Was the Doctor, yes. A new trailer for Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Okay.
And a trailer for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which looks pretty awesome, actually.
I saw the first three. The what are they, Swedish or whatever the hell they are?
Yeah.
Some other, right. Something that isn't English. Well, I mean, American. I saw those. Those are all right. Daniel Craig looks awesome. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So, but, you know, it's Fincher. So, he can direct the fuck out of a movie.
Oh, yeah.
He's a pretty good director.
I'll pretty much see it because he's directing it.
Yeah, we'll see.
So, yeah, that's what we got. And, you know, no big trailers hitting this week. As we're sort of in the thick of the summer movies already. So, you know.
David Arnaz died.
No?
Did you see that?
I did see that.
Or James Arnaz, the airplane guy. Peter Graves' brother.
Oh.
Yeah, he died. The guy from Gunsmoke. So did Jack Kevorkian, but he doesn't in movies.
No.
So.
Although I think they made a movie based on
It was awesome. It was called You Don't Know Jack. It had Al Pacino playing.
That's right.
And
I
think he got like a Golden Globe and shit for it. Good movie.
Sounds about right.
But yeah, I guess that brings us to an end of Geekly Happenings. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned. We're going to be right back. We're going to be talking about film noir as a movie genre.
Film noir.
Stuff. But now we're going to get to the meat of the show. What we like to do is Ethan and I think we know everything about everything ever, especially movies.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is we invite people on, and we invite them to pick the topic of the movie genre that we're going to be talking about tonight. Jean, you chose...
He's a Martian, you know.
Yeah, John, you chose film noir.
I chose a specific subgenre, but we can talk about film noir because I chose neo-noir.
You chose neo-noir? That's news to me.
That is... well, I think I mentioned it, but actually I'm doing... based on a series of blog posts I did, I'm actually doing a book about neo-noir. Let's talk about film noir in general, and we can talk about the evolution into neo-noir.
But my list has no neo-noir on it. I left it off intentionally.
Well, that's good, because that way our lists won't cross over, because I'm betting if you got four guys who all know film noir, their top 10 lists are going to overlap quite a bit.
I have a suspicion.
Mine goes all over the place, though.
I left neo-noir out, because I think it's a distinctly different genre.
It is a distinct genre. Thank you. You supported the thesis for the book.
Yeah, I mean it is. And
It's evolutionary. I don't think it's a clean break. And we can talk about the theory in a bit. But
you know what? It's about as clean of a break as, you know, a James Bond movie versus a spy movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they certainly have a lot of similarities, but they're different enough to where they deserve their own subgenre. But why did you choose what you chose?
I was doing a thing on the blog called Netflix Fridays about just what's streaming and what you probably haven't seen. Mm-hmm. And a couple of weeks in a row, I chose little neo-noirs in the 90s. And I said, you know, somebody should write a book about this. And I kind of poked my friend Eric Lichtenfeld, who wrote, in case you haven't read it, Action Speaks Louder Than Words. It is the best and possibly only both entertaining and scholarly analysis of the evolution of the action movie genre. It's a book I cannot recommend highly enough.
Okay.
And he said, actually, you know, I poked him. He said, listen, that actually there is a giant hole in scholarship in this particular field. You know, pretty much the only one is Foster Hirsch's Detours. And he wrote a bunch of books about classic noir and then kind of came to neo-noir in the 90s with a very, he didn't say jaded. I'll say this as having read the book, very sort of jaded, dismissive eye.
Sure.
And so I started to, in my spare time, work around the TV show. It's been a little slow, but I'm diving back in on hiatus. Try to work up an actual fairly rigorous analysis of neo-noir and how it evolved from classic noir and how it changed.
Okay, very good. What do you think about the genre, Ethan?
I think basically what I'm going to be doing is sort of acting as a bridge between the two of you guys, because I sort of put neo-noir and film noir. My list is composed of movies from both sides of that coin, really.
I do have one on my list that could arguably be considered neo-noir, but the rest of them are just flat-out old-school noir.
Sure. Well, I think... Classic. Yeah, I think, in film noir and neo-noir, I'm focusing more on the film noir aspect of it, is when film noir was developed, when it first started coming out, I think really when filmmaking started becoming much more of an art form,
mm-hmm.
With them being able to paint with light, being able to work with the lights and darks and in the black and white and eventually in color.
And you nailed it right there, because there's like three things to think about when I think of film noir.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fedora hat, cigarettes, and lighting.
Yeah.
It's all about the lighting
for me. Well, see, that's interesting, because what you're looking at there is you're taking a look at the genre. And by the way, there's people who argue film noir isn't a genre, it's a style, and I disagree with that. But you're looking at it from a very, very specifically stylistic standpoint, where to a great degree, I kind of like the original definition, the sort of qualities that Raymond Boy and Etienne Chumten did in their original write-up, although I think arguably Nino Frank did the first write-up of film noir in France. But in the Panorama du Film Noir American, in their retrospective, it's basically five qualities.
Mm-hmm.
It's cruelty, ambivalence, moral ambivalence, narrative ambivalence, eroticism, and they were super hot for the time.
Oh, yeah.
Strangeness, mm-hmm. and this is my favorite because it's the weirdest one, but it's the one I love, which is they use the word onieric, which is dreamlike quality.
Yeah.
It's a dreamlike quality to it. And it's interesting that the French, who defined the genre first, you know, Americans really didn't until the 70s. Start really looking at noir as a genre.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the director? Paul, he just died. Now it's going to drive me crazy.
We're checking it out.
out of my head. He wrote as a guy basically writing the guidebook for a film retrospective in New York in the 70s. See, I got Paul Verhoeven in my head, but it's not Verhoeven. A treatise called Film Noir is Not a Genre, in which he basically defined film noir
as a
genre. Paul Schrader. And so to me, you want to go back. And so when you're looking at the 70s definitions, the definitions that come up in the 70s, you're looking at it from very specifically people who came up post the moment, coming at it from a very film school analytical sense, rather from an artistic, we're living in the middle of this genre moment, mm-hmm. which the French had, because the French criticism evolved out of their criticism of Roman noir, which was their criticism or their, not criticism, but you know what I mean, their analysis of the American pulp, literature pulps, that the American film noir was were often direct adaptations of. And as a result, you know, I like that definition because it also has a very specific phrasing that it is film noir creates the same feeling of sort of anxiety or insecurity mm-hmm. that the character is feeling.
Right.
And to me, that allows you to look at film noir in a sense that is separate from all the stylistic stuff, because, you know, the stuff you're talking about, it's interesting. You mentioned two very specific things. You mentioned, and pardon me if I'm sort of rambling here, but I want to hear what you say, but I'd like to give us a base for discussion.
Yeah.
Which is, you said fedoras and painting with light.
Yeah.
And now painting with light comes out of, you know, the German expressionist movement that was really hitting American film at the time, as mm-hmm. you all know.
Yeah.
Fedoras come out of the literary source for film noir, which right. is the Roman noir, which is the crime stories and crime novels of the late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that the fedoras themselves were a subgenre of noir.
Yeah.
And that's so, you know, it's worth talking about, like, what, and I'll ask you guys, what are your markers for film noir? Mine are the emotional markers for film noir. And that's guided me in sort of looking at the genre and then looking at the evolution of neo-noir. What are the things that you look at and go, this is noir, or this is just a melodrama of the time?
Mm-hmm.
I was being very general when I say that those are the things that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Well, that's what people think of immediately. You think film noir, they immediately go into.
Don't we actually get into our list? Because my number six is going to lead into more of a discussion about, you know,
right.
what I more realized about film noir the more I thought about it. So, sure. What's your number six, Ethan?
Well, my number six movie I actually was just able to see recently, and it's by my favorite director of all time. It is High and Low, 1963, directed by Akira Kurosawa.
Fantastic movie.
Yeah, and it's a obviously Japanese.
Get the
Japanese
hell out of here.
Horror. Okay, bye. Oh, now, starring Toshirô Mifune, and it's about a shoe store mogul executive guy who basically receives a ransom demand for his son, but the kidnappers have kidnapped the son of his, I think it's his butler or his gardener or something like that.
His lifelong servant,
yeah. And it's sort of his inner turmoil of at first he decides he's not going to pay the ransom, then he decides he is going to pay the ransom, and it's sort of the horrible things he has to go through, because it sort of ruins him financially. He loses his job. He does all this stuff in order to get this son back. And Kurosawa, of course, is you know, this master filmmaker who can really, we said it, you know, paint with light and
yeah.
really paint with film in general, but he does this great job in that movie of just sort of capturing this grittiness and this sort of undercurrent. And I think that is one aspect of film noir that I've always loved, because it's not always a clean film. It's you're not looking at it as this, hey, it's bright, shiny and glitzy. You feel kind of grungy and dirty watching it. That to me is an aspect of film noir and even to an extent neo-noir. So 1963, High and Low, directed by Akira Kurosawa, the incomparable.
He's made some movies that are...
He's made one or two.
That don't suck. No, I really, really... I dig that movie. It's a very fantastic movie. Okay, John, what's your number six?
I'll go to neo-noir, since you guys are going to cover the classics pretty well. I'm going to go to little-known... totally tossed off movie from the height of neo-noir, 1990, After Dark, My Sweet, with James Foley, starring Jason Patrick.
That is a good movie.
which was an adaptation of a great novel. And it was, I think it was a Kane novel. I'm pretty sure. I always mix up Mike Thompson and Mike Kane. And I apologize for not being super prepped tonight. But it is the movie that made everyone think Jason Patrick was going to be the biggest star of the 90s. And his performance in it is stunning. It has all the moral ambiguity you want. It's very reminiscent of The Lookout.
Jim Thompson wrote the novel.
There you go. It's either Thompson or Kane, because that's the whole basis for neo-noir is Thompson and Kane.
Yeah.
With a little bit of Woolrich. It is James Foley, who did another great movie with Walken and Sean Penn. And now this isn't noir, I don't know it, but it's Sean Penn's the son who informs on Walken.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just a great crime director, and he was really doing interesting stuff. And just After Dark, My Sweet, you just feel like isn't a movie made in 1990. When you go back and watch it, it just steps way outside of its time period and feels like something a little something absolutely timeless. It holds up. Absolutely holds up.
No, that's – yeah, I probably haven't seen that in 20 years, 15 years.
Yeah.
It was an interesting movie, yeah.
It was totally ignored at the time. It didn't make any money, but it was the critical buzz from that launched Jason Patrick. Jason Patrick is a brain-damaged boxer who becomes a chauffeur, gets wrapped up in a kidnapping, and is in way over his head, but just has enough agency to sort of, you know, to skew the plot in his direction. It's eminently satisfying.
Yeah, very good movie. Have you seen it, Ethan?
I have not. I just added it to my Netflix queue now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And and like I said, it's reminiscent of The Lookout, directed and written by Scott Frank.
Nice.
Very good.
By the way, see The Lookout?
The Lookout's the one. Is that the one with
that's Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yes, thank you. Who, if you've listened to the show, we're both Aaron and I are huge fans of Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
So you guys have seen it.
Yes, the Lookout.
Yeah.
That's a very good movie.
Jeff Daniels is stunning in that.
Jeff Daniels is he needs to do more. I like him a lot. Okay. Well, yeah. No. Fantastic movie. Getting on to my number six. My number six is one that to me smacks as a number 10 that ought to be on my list. It ought to be a number 10 on my list for a couple of different reasons. One of which being that, you know, it's one of those sacred cows that, of course, you're going to put it on this fucking list. But I decided to put it number six because I knew that it was going to elicit some discussion because I had a blast making this list because there are so many great movies in this genre. I mean, I am enthralled with so many movies in this genre.
When I was making this list, I was amazed at how many I haven't seen.
Oh, I've seen. I'm like, oh man,
I need to see that one. I need to see that one. I haven't seen that one yet, and yeah, it was driving me nuts.
And the reason why that, and what I ended up doing was, you know, I sat down, I wrote it down, and I came up with about 20 off the top of my head. And I decided I was going to try to like narrow it down, so I looked up a list online of what is considered noir and what isn't considered noir, and my number six is one that it doesn't come across as noir at first, and then the more I thought about it, and it absolutely was, and so I had to put it on my list, and it's actually Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane is arguably the first film noir. Absolutely correct.
You think film noir, I don't want to name them off because I'll be thrown off other people's lists, but you know, you think the Fedora movies with the cigarettes and all that stuff, and which, Citizen Kane had that. But it's absolutely the tone of that movie that makes it film noir.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not a crime movie in the sense. It doesn't have the MacGuffin.
And when you're thinking film noir, I mean, you're immediately thinking Deep Dark Shadows and all that. And that movie's got all that stuff in it, too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You can – there. The argument – the classic canon definition of the beginning of film noir is Maltese Falcon. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely of the school that you can argue that it is Citizen Kane. German Expressionism at its height and really mainstreamed by that movie – from the visual style sense, absolutely. And then you can argue from story and atmosphere, you can go all the way back to Shanghai Lady.
Yeah,
I think it was 38.
That was another one I was actually considering, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, there you go. But Citizen Kane, good, absolutely a solid argument for the beginning of the film.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just the whole thing about it is, I didn't consider it film noir, and then I thought about it for about 30 seconds, like, well, fuck. It is film noir, and how in the hell can I exclude Citizen Kane from a list about great movies when I don't think it would make it much further than, it would probably make my top 10 favorite movies, period, of all time. So, I mean, I got to put it on my top six, you know, film noir list. So, yeah, I pick, I mean, I love that movie. And I think it's funny that, like, somebody that's not very well versed in film or film history, you know, grows up watching, you know, Transformers and American Pie and that crap, will watch that movie and they won't think there's anything great about it. But it's because of the fact of the way that that movie is, well, first off, you know, I'm not talking about the noir aspects of it right now. I'm just going to talk about the technical achievements of that film.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, that movie is, it had as many special effects as, like, Star Wars
It's one of those movies that I,
Invisible effects.
Yeah, and it's sort of upsetting that nowadays people watch it and go, oh, it wasn't very good. Yeah. I'm like,
fuck, Lord of the Rings is better than that.
Like this movie, this movie is responsible for so much innovation in filmmaking in general that, you know, I mean, that's all become old hat now.
Yeah, I mean, have
you read James Gleick's book, The Information?
No,
I have not.
The History of Information Theory. There's a great bit in it where he talks about the creation of writing and language and quoting, you know, there's no one was ever able to sit down and go, today I'll be the first man to write. Yeah, because and there is pre-literacy and post-literacy, and it's a hard line. And once you are post-literate, you literally can't wrap your head around the idea of being pre-literate and looking at the world that way. Citizen Kane is the hard defining line between filmmaking, post-Citizen Kane and pre-Citizen Kane. And because we live post-Citizen Kane, it's almost impossible to understand what it must have been like to see that movie the first time.
It is, and you actually have to educate yourself on that movie to understand what it did. And when you do that, it's mind blowing what that movie did for this medium.
I mean, I argue it essentially starts this. Citizen Kane is the start of this big film renaissance that basically happened. You know, which created this serious art form that you could see instead of going, well, we're going to go see the funny pictures tonight. It was no, we're going to go see a film.
Yeah, and exactly.
You know, we're going to watch this and look at basically moving pieces of art.
It's also, shoot me in the head, John, but I don't think that studio involvement is 100% of the time a bad thing in a movie.
Yeah.
100%.
No, not at all. 100%. No, It's not always a bad thing in any way, shape, or form.
I don't think there are, and you would be lying if you said there aren't people that think that. And Orson Welles is always the one that gets pulled out. You know, when he was left alone, we got Citizen Kane, and then you know, it's just a mind bending, breathtaking, wonderful movie, and it's my number six. And I just I love this movie. It's just so sacred cow, I couldn't put it number one. I mean, that's way too expected. So, I guess, it's my number six. What's your number five, Ethan?
Well, my number five is goes into a director that really, when you think film noir, you immediately think of Orson Welles and other directors. But to me, this movie sort of in his black and white, quote unquote black and white period, it's the 1950 Alfred Hitchcock Strangers on a Train.
That is my number five as well.
It's you don't really think film noir when you think Alfred Hitchcock. When you think Alfred Hitchcock, you think thriller, and not the Michael Jackson video.
sure,
and
you do.
That's what you think, but you just have to go back and think. Well. Film noir in and of itself can be obviously a thriller. It can have these elements, but Strangers on a Train has that just darkness to it. It has that grittiness. It has that really good anti-hero, but heroic characters in just the whole concept of the movie is you have, you know, the two guys switching murders basically, and one is not really very serious about it, and the other guy is dead serious about it, and.
Remade is Throw Mama from the Train.
Oh, God.
I love that movie. Shut the fuck up, Ethan. I love Throw Mama from the Train. I like Strangers on a Train better.
Oh, yeah. Strangers on a Train is great. That's my... Hitchcock actually showed up a couple times when I was researching for this one.
Yeah.
And Strangers on a Train just sort of reminds me and really pulls me into that whole film noir aspect. And it's probably just because... It utilizes as Hitchcock always did.
Yeah, I almost put the
camera so well.
I almost put the 39 Steps in here, but I just didn't want to spend this whole damn time arguing because that's another one you could argue whether it is or it isn't film noir. So I just didn't want to argue about it. No, I love that movie. It's my number five also.
Cool.
So I guess we're on to your number five now, John.
Number five for me. See, I kind of jumbled them around, but if I'm going to put them in order, I'm going to throw something in here. Red Rock West by John Dahl.
Sweet.
1992, very end of the classic neo-noir cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Red Rock West, John Dahl directs. It was a little indie. It got a weird direct-to-video release. Mm-hmm. Not get a theatrical release until it was released by a small theater in California, started getting buzzed. Nick Cage is the drifter who drifts into town and is mistaken for a killer. And it's kind of everything cool about the funny end of noir.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time that there is a lot of comedy and sort of mistaken identities, there is genuine threat and genuine anxiety. J.T. Walsh plays the hitter who eventually comes to town. And
man, I miss him.
He is J.T. Walsh. Incredible. Yeah. He is like a dark center of gravity in this movie. Mm-hmm. And it is sort of it's the perfect classic noir structure.
Yeah.
Dude comes to town. He's the fall guy. He's not as smart as he thinks he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes into town in a bad way. He gets out of town in a bad way. And it really is. I think it's streaming again. I'm not sure. You might be able to watch it Netflix streaming. But John Dahl then sort of blew on the screen like a year later with Last Seduction, mm-hmm. which to me is the classic end, the end of the classic neo-noir cycle. So this is an early work by a guy.
Once again, that was another great movie. I like Last Seduction.
I mean, not to always do two and cheat, but Red Rock West, I guarantee you, most people listening have never seen. It's well worth seeing for J.T. Walsh alone.
I don't think I've seen it, but I love J.T. Walsh. I mean, he's one of those people that I never thought got the...
And it's Nicolas Cage. It's Nicolas Cage being like good Nicolas Cage.
Yeah,
like the guy that you wanted in your quirky movies.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
It's really... go watch it. It's fantastic. You haven't seen it, and it's great neo-noir.
Okay.
Added to the Netflix queue. I have a feeling I'm going to be doing that a lot with your list, John.
Yeah. I mean, I will, too, if we run into many I haven't seen, because I love this genre, and I just want to eat it up. It's such a great, great, great genre. I guess we already hit my number five, so we're going to be right on to Ethan's number four. Yeah.
And oddly, Alfred Hitchcock managed to get side by side on my list. We're obviously entering into a color, and even this one was also released in 3D. It's 1954 Dial M for Murder.
You know, I almost put that on my list.
And it's on here more of that I absolutely love this Hitchcock movie. It's your usual Hitchcock, you know, type of thing. It's, you know, obviously it involves the whole murder aspect. And there's the the husband hires someone else to kill his wife, and it all sort of goes awry. And again, it has Hitchcock's great camera control, great painting with visual medium, and it's just on here. Probably the best way to describe it for me. It's on here just because it's one of my favorite movies. And
surprised you've seen it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's Hitchcock.
So, I mean, you haven't seen a lot of movies, it seems like, sometimes.
You know.
Cool.
So, yeah, it's noir in the, it's actually my first color one that's I've got on here is this one.
I'm not I got
others on this list, but it's the first one I'm mentioning here that is
I've only got one color one.
Yeah, and Dial M for Murder, I think, does a great job of still being this dim, dark, and gritty, but being in color. And I think it's just a testament to Hitchcock and his ability as a filmmaker. And so there you have it.
Cool. No, great movie. Great movie. Now, you might be all confused and stuff, John, but it's now time for your number four.
Oh, all right. My number four would be, Red Rock West, After Dark, My Sweet. I'm going to go with The Hot Spot, 1990. Dennis Hopper directing, based on a 1952 novel, with Don Johnson starring, Virginia Madsen, and just a smoking hot Jennifer Connelly as the innocent girl in town. Just blow your head clean off your shoulders, hot Jennifer Connelly in this movie.
She's beautiful.
It is. What's that?
She's beautiful in the movie.
She is idyllic. And to me, this is kind of the perfect neo-noir. And again, we'll talk about the difference later as we talk about genres once we've gone through our list. Don Johnson blows into town, he blows out of town. It is, it is an episode, it is a voyage. It is about a guy who's not as smart as he thinks he is. A guy gets in over his head, whose operating system is corruption. Don Johnson, probably for his leading roles, his best role. He's great in Tin Cup, side role, but, you know, for his leading role, his best role. Great script, hot little script that Dennis Hopper found in, like, a trunk. Like, he found the adaptation of this 1952 novel in a trunk and then updated it. It is added to your Netflix queue. Again, nobody's seen it. I mention it all the time, and nobody ever seen the goddamn thing. And it is a great classic neo-noir. Hotspot, 1990, Dennis Hopper directing, one of a handful he's directed.
He directed some interesting movies.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, yeah.
And he was quite the Renaissance man when it came to film. So I guess, yeah, it's not streaming right now, but, you know, you can add it, so... But cool.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that pops in and out depending on the release schedule and when they're doing the, the DVD releases and all the rest of it.
Sure. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Aaron,
okay, we're gonna hit my number four. My number four is one that, believe it or not, we're gonna have another Hitchcock movie. I chose the 1958 Vertigo. That is a movie that. In terms of Hitchcock movies, he's made better movies.
Yeah.
He's made,
It's not one of my favorites, honestly.
It's just such a cerebral movie. Mm-hmm. And Hitchcock, a lot of the times he didn't make movies like, he didn't have movies with hidden agendas and stuff like that. I mean, just the fact that, you have Jimmy Stewart dealing with this bullshit that's going on and everything. It's just such it's an interesting movie, and, obviously Hitchcock was, a very, very, very talented dude when it comes to knowing what to do with the cameras, or at the very least knowing the right people to hire that know where a camera goes. But I like a lot of Hitchcock movies better, but I think that this is one of his best noir films. I mean, I really enjoy it, and I don't have a lot to say about it, but I do really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing Hitchcock really did a lot, and one thing he liked, which is a sort of a staple of a lot of film noir stuff, was the whole fish out of water
thing. Yeah.
It's this guy who is everyday guy who gets put into a fantastic situation by happenstance, and Hitchcock did quite a bit. It's a staple of film noir. I mean, it's a bit of a staple of my number three. Which is, I couldn't make this list without putting this on here. It was the 1941 directed by John Huston, Maltese Falcon.
My number two.
And
there you go. There's Huston. I was waiting for Huston.
Yeah, he's exactly. My number two. John Huston, one of the greatest directors ever.
Yeah.
And the Maltese Falcon.
Is he interested in Sierra Madre yet?
No.
God damn it, dude.
Sorry, dude. Working on it. it's the role you remember Bogart. And you think Bogart, you immediately think Sam Spade.
Well,
or Rick in Casablanca, sure. But you think Bogart, you think the fedora and the private eye to me, and that's Maltese Falcon. And Maltese Falcon is I think one of those quintessential film noirs out there. That's just
absolutely.
It's got it all. It's got the femme fatale. It's got
Sidney Greenstreet.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's got the MacGuffin.
It's got,
for God's sake,
totally got the MacGuffin in there, and it's a fantastic movie. It's if you are remotely interested in finding out what the hell film noir even is,
yeah, that's a good place to start.
This movie, just go Maltese Falcon, get it.
It is. I mean, it's a great place to start because a lot of people do argue it's the first of the cycle.
Way. I mean, it might be the first classic.
I wouldn't say it's the first of the cycle, obviously, but it is. It is amazing.
When
film.
People say the cycle of classic noir rather than the influence of the late 30s, early 40s. Maltese Falcon 1941 is like the starting gun.
Yeah.
Right? Most people consider noir.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's a fantastic movie.
It's the one that's parodied. It's the one that's, that is sort of the template for film noir out there. It's like, well, you got the Private Eye and the Mysterious Woman.
Speaking of which, Eric Lichtenfeld, who wrote that book, gave me one of the best quotes I have when people argue, something like a genre or a style. And it's from one of his teachers at film school. If something can be parodied, it exists.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fact that the Maltese Falcon can be parodied and its film noir can be parodied establishes it to me as a genre.
Oh, yeah. Totally. So, John, what is your number three? What is
number
your
three.
Number three? I'm torn because you have to. I'm going a lot of early 90s here. And
just so you know, my number three is going to be a neo-noir.
Oh, cool.
So
I should hop on a classic and just pull one out of my ass.
There you go.
But no, I'm going to go Blood Simple.
I love that movie. Yeah. I love that movie.
Coen Brothers blowing onto the scene. Great twisty plot, despair, really use light and color, and really they set the color palette for what neo-noir would be. It is super early in the cycle, arguably the first one of the neo-noir cycle, when you put Body Heat like as its own thing, because it is, you know, its own thing. But yeah, Blood Simple, again, you can argue that the Coen brothers work solely in crime world. And as a result, it's kind of weird to go to them because whenever you go to them, they're going to be doing some variation of noir. But in the overall neo-noir school, Blood Simple, that's the starting gun for me.
I know when we discussed crime and gangster films, the Coen brothers came up many times.
Oh, many times.
That's their work.
I'm absolutely enthralled with them. I mean, they're some of the best working directors that are around. I mean, they're just fantastic. Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people don't get the ending of that movie. I mean, just how bleak and horrible the ending of that movie is.
Isn't it wonderful how, oh man, it's just got a fucked up ending.
Yeah, it's and people argue it's too gory. It's not gory. It's just a lot of great actors working in their first or early roles. You know, again, great movie, Blood Simple, 84.
Cool. That's a fantastic movie. Are we on to my number three?
We are.
My number three, like I already teased, is actually neo-noir in the sense of, you know, it's, I don't know, I mean, it just depends on, you know, how you're going to define the two, but this is one that, when I got to thinking about it, because, you know, I my list almost got rebuilt from the ground up when I so succinctly realized that Citizen Kane is indeed noir, and it just made me rethink everything. And, you know, so I started thinking about that feeling of despair and helplessness and like just like that feeling that the atmosphere of the movie is a character in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And I just kept coming back to the same movie that, you know, personified that to me. And that would have been 1974 Roman Polanski film Chinatown.
It's my number nine.
I just... don't you just feel nasty watching that movie?
Yes.
It's got one of the most fucked up endings ever.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought it was interesting that Nicholson got cut early in the movie and he's got a big bandage on his face through like the whole goddamn movie.
Yeah.
I just, or his nose. Was his nose or his lip?
It was his nose.
Yeah, it was his nose. It's got, first off, Faye Dunaway.
Oh, yeah.
Fuck. She's...
talk about quintessential femme fatale right there.
I'll come back for the next show when we do top 10 improbably hot actresses of the past.
Yes. Faye Dunaway.
We'll just do that list straight through. Angie Dickinson and Rio Bravo. We'll hit them all.
Yeah. All right. Good night. We got to be right back for the show. Yeah. No. I love that movie. I'm one of those, you know, sons of bitches that's probably going to burn in hell that I can separate what somebody does personally and what they do professionally. And I love Polanski as a director. And I think that he never did better than Chinatown.
There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I murder hobos on the weekend. You still like Blue Beetle. I mean,
That's true. Yeah.
Blue Beetle's pretty badass. So.
Do it to see the light go out of their eyes. I still write stuff you enjoy.
Well, there you go. I love Chinatown. And it's my number three. And this is a list that's actually kind of more constructed for discussion than how I really feel. But yeah, I do really like it a lot.
Yeah, Chinatown is one of those. By the time I saw it, I'd seen Maltese Falcon and Citizen Kane, all those, and it really is one of those. You sort of look at it and go, and it feels like it was made. It's just in color and has, you know, more contemporary of the time actors.
I'd almost like to see it.
It feels like it was made back in the 40s.
I'd like to see it desaturized and black and white. That'd be an interesting
thing. Well, I mean, here's a good question. It's like, if you look at noir, a big part of what classic noir was, it was there were not a lot of historical noirs back in noir because it was specifically addressing, the zeitgeist, America's anxiety over cities. And dehumanization and the post-war mood or the during the war mood. And this, by the way, is not saying Chinatown isn't one of my favorite movies and everything, but I would actually put Chinatown in the same bucket as L.A. Confidential.
Neo-noir.
They are retro noirs. They are noirs that are very aware of the tropes of noirs, and they put a new spin on it. Although I would argue L.A. Confidential is more of a straight-up historical, China is a subversion or almost satirical extension of the form.
Yeah, because you don't feel as shitty watching L.A. Confidential.
L.A. Confidential is almost like a museum piece.
Oh, yeah. I love L.A. Confidential.
It's a great movie, but it is like a beautifully restored ship.
Yeah, and now that you might mention it, but my number two is L.A. Confidential.
Yeah.
There you go.
I knew it was going to show up on your list.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You can hop straight to that. That's beautiful.
It is one of my all-time favorite movie. Yeah, talk about it. It's the best segue ever.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And, you know, I think you're right, though. It feels like a museum piece. It feels like a really good, beautiful nod to two movies like Chinatown, two movies like Maltese Falcon, even to an extent, and where you have this sort of grit to it. But it's really sort of... I was trying to find a good term for it. I don't want to say sort of a glossy grit, but it is there.
It
lacks the ambivalence.
Right. There you go.
Yeah, right. That's what it is. It lacks. It's a great movie. It's a beautiful movie. The performances are great. Curtis Hanson directed that?
Yes, he did.
Yes. 1997.
He directed the shit out of it.
Oh, yeah.
But at no point are you kind of lost in the morality.
Exactly.
You know, and that's to me, and like I said, that's why I always go back to the original French. We are looking at these films as they are happening right now. Because the emotionality of noir is to me what defines it.
Oh, you know,
that L.A. Confidential is a great movie, but it's like somebody beautifully reconstructed.
Yeah,
like that it's almost like L.A. Noir, the video game.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like we beautifully reconstructed this city, and we are moving objects and people through it.
Mm-hmm. And there just happens to be a camera here to catch it all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's my love of the movie is well known, and you know it totally got robbed of an Academy Award in my opinion, but it is a masterpiece, and up to 2007 was arguably one of the best movies of the last 10 years. Now I think it's still one of the best movies of the last 15 years.
Oh sure.
And you know it was on my crime and gangster list, and this is just
it's a staple.
Yes, it's a staple. It's hard. It's hard to put my love of the movie into words, and the noir feeling in it isn't an overpowering one, but I think it is. It's obvious. It obviously has roots in neo noir and film noir.
Yeah.
All right. Well, John, what's your number two?
Number three. Oh, I lost you here. Hold on a second.
Maybe his number two, right?
Yeah.
This would be my number two.
Yes.
All right. I'm torn.
Sucks, doesn't it? Imagine doing this every week.
Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, here's the thing: is like I've got one. The two I've left in my top five. There's one very standard choice and one very offbeat choice. And I want to make the offbeat choice number one, but I don't actually, honestly, I'm not actually sure it's the better movie. But I'm going to put number three as Body Heat, 1981.
Fantastic movie. Oh, yeah. God, I love that movie.
A very aware reconstruction of Double Indemnity, and you know, it has its issues, but. I mean, Lawrence Kasdan, I mean, first off, that's the first movie in his incredible streak of the 80s and early 90s.
Yeah.
Of just, you know, just writing every great, you know, hit movie of the time. But here's the thing about Body Heat. Even though it's aware, it's honest. He is making the story of corruption happen at the time. It's it's current. It's relevant. The characters are grounded and real. I can't believe I'm but Ted Danson plays the lawyer friend who's smarter than William Hurt. And this is the classic James Cain, Jim Thompson protagonist that is a dude that is nowhere near as clever as he thinks he is and is being undone by his own corruption. Is the fact he works in and you can smell the reek of corruption off this movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just the rot of hot Southern Florida and. Besides the amazing dialogue, you know, Kasdan that puts in their mouths, there's so many interesting shot choices in here and interesting moments. Some of it's a little turgid. The score is one of those early 80s synth abominations. You know, you wish you could go back and rescore it, even with like today's sort of orchestra sounding electronics. It has flaws, but this thing is one of those ones that you watch and every character is sketched in one line of dialogue. Mm-hmm. There's not a wasted moment. There's not a wasted beat. There's not a fat line in this thing. It is a masterclass of screenwriting. And then he turns around and directs the hell out of it. Mm-hmm. Body Heat, 81, Lawrence Kasdan. Too early to really be the starting gun for noir, but it's the one that showed the studios you can make money at it.
Yeah, and it's been 15 years since I've seen this movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And you know, I don't know that I've ever thought of Lawrence Kasdan as the force that he is, but you're 1,000% mm-hmm. right. I mean, hell, I looked over at the wall and I saw his name on a movie poster. So, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, and I only got two posters on the wall. So, I mean, wow. No, Lawrence, I mean, it's a fantastic movie.
Kasdan, okay, Kasdan's run. I'm not going to look it up. I'm going to see if I can do this from memory because I'm going to miss something. All right. Raiders, Body Heat.
I'm watching Return it tonight on Netflix.
Big Chill.
Empire.
Silver Rock. And then he goes. Then he does his own stuff. He does like Grand Canyon. I think he did Wyatt Earp. But that was in a row, guys.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. He did Empire. No. Wait. All right. I am.
He did Empire.
It's gonna drive me crazy. He did Empire first.
Yeah. He took over. He took over writing the screenplay for Empire Strikes Back after Lee Brackett died.
Lee Brackett died, of course. Mm-hmm. Yes. And Lee Brackett, one of the great underappreciated screenwriters.
Oh, she was fantastic.
Yeah. And a real inspiration for female writers everywhere because mm-hmm. she made her line and she made her market in a time when women just were not, there weren't a lot of doors open for them in screenwriting.
Yeah.
But that's Empire, Raiders, Body Heat, Return, Big Chill, Silverado in a row.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, who the hell else has that?
He absolutely is a force to be reckoned with. I mean, and I never really thought of him like that before, but you're 100% right. And happily, this movie is available on instant stream right now. I know what I'm watching tonight.
There you go. Yeah, and there's gonna be problems with it. You're gonna go like, okay, this is a little slow. No, but
I've seen it. I really dug it.
Mm-hmm.
I really dug it.
Yeah, and I don't have a lot to say about it because it's been 15 years since I saw the thing. So I mean, it's I remember loving every second of it myself and thinking, great writing, it was just a perfect storm of. Awesome, really.
Yeah,
if you're a screenwriter, watching Body Heat is just like having somebody work your ribs.
Yes.
Because it's just, I can't believe somebody's this fucking good.
Yeah. My number two was Maltese Falcon.
Oh, okay.
We already talked about that.
So we're on to my number one. Yep. And really, no surprise, you knew it's going to hit my list because every chance I get, I scream about how much I love this movie. It's Blade Runner. 1982, directed by Ridley Scott.
Certainly it's noir, but it's more sci-fi.
Yeah, but the noir in it, I see it as sci-fi noir, really.
Sure.
But noir sort of crosses all genres, in my opinion. And that movie, my love of it is also well documented. And it has that oppressive feeling. It has, and not only is it the setting where it's at, and just the horrible smog ridden, dank, dreary, brainy. It takes that Maltese Falcon approach. It takes that that gumshoe and puts him in this future, this lived-in future that's just gritty, grimy, nasty, horrible. You feel so horribly oppressed by it. And then you put him up against these fantastic things of these androids doing their thing. And it's, you sort of look at it just from those plot points. You're going, yeah, this sounds like standard science fiction. But then Ridley Scott manages to weave into it these absolutely fantastic noir aspects to it, and he calls it future noir, I mean, and that's what it is. And to me, as a noir film, it is my personal absolute favorite. You have these great characters, one thing I like to say is film noir is the reason that we know who Peter Lorre is.
Yep.
And Peter Lorre, of course, had this absolutely fascinating face.
Yep.
And in Blade Runner, I mean, you have these characters. You have Rutger Hauer. You have James Hong. You have all these characters that have these fascinating faces, these fascinating images of just looking at them. You're just like, there's a story to that guy. And I think that itself makes that movie so special to me. So
yeah, no, it's a fantastic movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know that first off, I wasn't even thinking neo-noir at all for this list. And
sure.
I don't know. I probably would have left it off because it hit my sci-fi list, but I love that movie. It's fantastic movie.
I can't love that movie more.
Okay, really. Cool. Well, that's your number one. What do you say, John? What's your favorite?
All right. Carl Franklin's One False Move, 1992.
Right on.
Billy Bob Thornton co-wrote.
That's such a good movie.
Carl Franklin directs. Carl Franklin's doing a lot of television now. He's a fantastic director. And when you talk about, again, movies that nobody has goddamn seen, this thing is just a gut punch, beat after beat. And this is the perfect – the reason it's my number one is the perfect example when I talk about the sort of emotional context for noir for me. It is a slow-motion car crash. Everybody's making the wrong choice. You can see the elements coming together. And at the same time, you cannot wait for them to collide. You dread what is going to happen when they do. It starts with one of the greatest, most violent. And really, a lot of people can't get past the heist in the opening because it's so violent. But, you know, that's what murder looks like in crime world, kids. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And it's got, you know, Paxton is fucking incredible.
He's one of those people that sometimes just turns in incredible work and sometimes he doesn't.
I gotta tell you, man, he's fantastic in this. He is the loudmouth sheriff that everyone loves and a little bit in over his head. The LA cops or character actors in over their head. It is, you feel anxious when you watch this movie and it holds up, and the main antagonists and protagonists do not meet until the last 7 minutes of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you are riveted for the whole rest of the runtime waiting for that moment. And that to me is, and that's what makes it my number one, because it's kind of like my little gem. It's the movie that I have in my pocket that I know isn't the number one on anybody else's list. You know what I mean? Yeah. But to me, that I can watch that movie. And now it's not, I'm not as big a fan of the script as Body Heat, because Kasdan's a writer, you know, Garrett Ryder's writer. Sure. Well, this was very much written, you know, in the service to the movie and the acting. These are really actors' pieces in this movie. But Carl Franklin, it's amazing. It's an amazing flick. Nobody's ever seen it. 92, one false move. Might be streaming, might not be.
It
I
is
don't know,
streaming.
Go. Yeah. Clear out an hour and a half of your life and watch that movie.
Now, I saw that when I was going through a crime movie. I don't know, marathon when I was, 25, something like that. That was a great movie. That was in my Billy Bob Thornton thing when I found out he wasn't a fucking idiot.
Thornton was writing. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, right. It was when I found out that he wasn't just like that guy that did that dumb TV show. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Great movie. And I do recommend it. I guess it's my number one already.
Yes, we are.
All right. My number one, maybe I lied a little bit when I said that, I didn't rewrite my list because, when I figured out everything with Citizen Kane and it made me completely rethink the genre. And then I started looking at lists, and this is one that I probably maybe would have hit my list if I hadn't rethought it. Is a 1950 film directed by the incomparable Billy Wilder. It's Sunset Boulevard. I
have that movie waiting for me at home right now.
I am in love and enthralled with that movie. It is obviously not the first movie you think of when you think about noir. It isn't. But when
there's no Double Indemnity here. None of us hit Double Indemnity, which is insane.
I haven't seen Double Indemnity. I haven't seen Double Indemnity. Of the AFI Top 100 movies, there's four movies I have not seen on it, and that's one of them.
Oh man!
So I'm eagerly trying to, you know, fix that. But you know, as of tonight, I haven't seen that movie yet. but I love. First off, I love Billy Wilder. I don't remember where it's on my list, but I also had Lost Weekend on here, which is a fantastic movie. But Sunset Boulevard isn't film noir in the sense of, you know, like I was saying, you know, with the fedoras and the cigarette smokes and all that. But it does have that feeling of just like the utter despair and the world sucks and everybody's out to get you and, you know, stuff like that going through it. And Gloria Swanson's performance in that movie is maybe once in a generation. I mean, it is... It's an incendiary performance. I mean, she fucking scares you. She scares you to death. She's got it's one of those. It opens in that classical sense of having the having narration, which is something that, you know, it's not necessarily exclusive to noir.
No, but it's a stylistic hallmark.
It's definitely a staple of the genre.
I mean, it is, yeah. And it's actually one of if we ever did a top six favorite narration moments, William Holden in that movie would probably be my number one. I mean, because just because of the Ethan hasn't seen it, so I don't want to spoil it. But the situation of that speech at the beginning of the movie and where he is at the time and everything going on, it's just crazy. And I don't know, something to me, and I could just be way off base here, but the fact that you have people like DeMille in that movie and Buster Keaton and who was playing poker in that scene. It was Buster Keaton, Cecil B. DeMille, I don't remember, but all these aging Hollywood icons who were hanging out with Gloria Swanson. It's, I don't know, just something about them playing themselves in that movie. And I'm ready for my close up, Mr. DeVille. Just makes that movie so disparaging. So you don't feel like there's any hope going through this movie. And it's just one of those. I mean, it doesn't quite make me feel as dirty as like Chinatown or something like that. Mm-hmm. But man, is it an interesting. And I love this movie. And I don't know where I would have put it if I hadn't realized that it was film noir. So I love it, and it's my number one.
I mean, it's definitely kind of. It's Wilder's arguably his satire about Hollywood.
Oh yeah,
And that's one of the things where you talk about noir as genres intermixing. He uses the film noir style to write a satire that's disguised as a noir. It's one of his greatest movies. I mean, there's no argument whatsoever. It's a fantastic movie. But now we have to do the other ones because we've left over a ton of classic directors here and director in classic movies.
Oh yeah, and you mentioned Double Indemnity, and I'll just go ahead and do my rundown. Double Indemnity is number 10 on my list. 1944, directed by Billy Wilder, and it's another one of those quintessential film noirs out there. I think obviously number 9, Chinatown, directed by Roman Polanski, 1974. Number 8. Is the 1958 Touch of Evil, directed by Orson Welles. Another wonderful staple, movie. I think. Number 7 is the 1998 Dark City, directed by Alex Proyas.
I like that movie.
Number 6,
nice.
Yeah. Which one? What, Dark City?
Nice, Dark City.
Yes, yeah. I just watched it again just the other day. Love it. Number 6, High and Low. Number 7, Strangers on a Train. Number 4, Dial M for Murder. Number 3, The Maltese Falcon. Number 2, L.A. Confidential. And number 1, Blade Runner.
Cool. Well, do you want to hit your top, your 10?
Sure. All right. Let's see here. No particular order in that back 5, because like you said, they're honorable mentions. I like this system, by the way. I might steal this system for mine.
There you go. Nice. Well, we stole it from Siskel and Ebert, so you're not stealing it from us.
In no particular order, you have to throw Basic Instinct in there.
You do?
I do. I'll tell you why.
I actually love Basic Instinct.
But specifically in the noir school, it is Schumacher really paints with color the way that they painted with light in the class in German Expressionism. He really is responsible. Really takes advantage, really explores the sort of polychromatic palette there. Sure. of symbolic color, the way that symbolic light was used in noir. It is lurid. It is relevant. It's the reason it feels cheesy is it's dirty.
Yeah.
And it's the same way, if somebody caught you looking at cheap pornography that arouses you, it's cheap pornography that arouses you. I mean, it's still pornography, and it gets the job done, and it's even worse because it's embarrassing. You know what I mean? Basic Instinct, number 10, probably. Blue Velvet, 1986. Oof. Perfectly good noir detective story.
Ethan hates David Lynch, if I remember right.
Stand David Lynch.
I like that movie.
David Lynch, you cannot like him, but I will say that that is a great neo-noir. This one's weird. Okay, I'm leaving Last Seduction off, by the way, just because it's the end of the classic neo-noir cycle to me. But it's a great film. Shattered.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Shattered is a movie that should not be as good or as interesting as it is. Tom Berenger.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. All right, 1991. Okay, it's Berenger. It's not Gretchen Mol. It's the pre-Gretchen Mol. Who is it? Greta Sacchi.
There you go.
Sacchi. Bob Hoskins, Joanna Wally,
Ooh.
I love me some Bob Hoskins.
Yeah, here you go. Tom Berenger is in a car crash. Okay, he's in a car crash. He's an industrialist. His face is reconstructed after the car crash because the injury was so bad they had to reconstruct his memory as white. So you start peeling the layers back on what it could be one of the very run-of-the-mill erotic thrillers of the 90s, and you find all the classic noir elements executed really well. Wolfgang Peterson directing. I think it's one of the first ones, one of his first movies,
mm-hmm.
That in America.
Yeah.
It might be his first movie. No, he did never. Yeah. Enemy Mine and then Shattered. Yeah. His first real movie. It fulfills for me what like Scarlet Street and those movies are in classic noir, which it is a melodrama, but it is well executed and well written, and the actors all commit, and it has all the dreamlike qualities of a noir. Next one down, because I'm forcing myself to stay in classic neo-noir rather than going outside like the trailers. Because you could put The Limey in here, but that's too late for me. I got to go Limey. House of Games, David Mamet.
I'm sorry, which one?
87, House of Games, David Mamet.
Oh, Mamet.
Unreliable narrator. Really, really cool. It's got the cool elements of the noir reflected in the mirror of neo. The betrayals, Montaigne's a guy, an actor from the 40s who somehow wound up working in the 80s and 90s. Yeah, it's just a great little neo-noir. And then you're down to the other ones, which is, mm-hmm. you know, After Dark, My Sweet, Red Rock West, Hot Spot, Blood Simple, Body Heat, and then One False Move.
Very good. Yeah, and I think it's something that I've just never articulated before, but that is pretty much what 6-10 is honorable mentions, and the order isn't that important. I picked the 1940, once again, Alfred Hitchcock film, Rebecca. That's mm-hmm. the only, well, I don't know about only, but it's the Hitchcock film, the one Best Picture. Then we got the 1946 Tay Garrett film, The Postman Always Rings Twice.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those, you know, I mean, if we ever do like a seductive, steamy list, it's going to be on there also, because, sure. man, that movie's kind of awesome like that. My number, fuck that. My number seven is, excuse me, number eight is The Lost Week in 1945, Billy Wilder. And my number eight is the 1949 Carol Reed film, The Third Man. That's another one.
Oh, I love that movie.
Love that movie.
My wife's favorite movie, actually.
I'm ashamed to say I haven't seen it
yet. It's on Instant Stream, dude.
I know.
It's such a great movie. It's one of, you know, I mean, yeah, Orson Welles gave us, you know, the wonderful Citizen Kane, but I think that his performance in this is probably better than it mm-hmm. was in Citizen Kane.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah, and it's absolutely representative of the idea that the film noir it operates in a world of corruption.
Oh yeah,
you know it's really really a great choice, Caroline. Nice choice.
Yeah, I mean I that's another one of those movies that I love. And then we get down to what I talked about already: Citizen Kane, Strangers on a Train, Vertigo. What was my number three? Chinatown. Then Maltese Falcon. And my favorite is Sunset Boulevard by Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder's a great director. Man, I like him.
Mm-hmm.
Great director.
And you know, he really only started directing so people wouldn't fuck up his words.
Yep. Yeah, that's I've actually read that before. Did you know he is single-handedly responsible for Billy Bob Thornton's writing career?
I did not know that. That's cool.
He was, sort of, because Billy Bob Thornton was working as a waiter in L.A. Not a waiter. What are those people at parties called that carry around hors d'oeuvres and shit?
Yeah, waiter.
Okay, maybe it is a waiter. He was working in L.A., and Billy Wilder was at a party, and he goes up to Billy Wilder and says, "Hey, I like your work, and I'm going to be an actor." And he looked at Billy Bob Thornton. He said, "You know what? You are way too goddamn ugly to be an actor. You need to, if you really want to act in a movie, you need to go and you need to write yourself out a part." And so he took that insult and advice, and he turned it into Sling Blade, for which is what he won his Academy Award for.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
So, yeah, that's it's great. Great genre, great directors. Yeah, I had a blast talking this genre. Yeah. I've been looking forward to this one for weeks because, you know,
we wound up because I wound up hanging out in the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. you know, we wound up skipping over You know, Preminger.
Oh, sure.
A lot of Billy Wilder, Nicholas Ray. You know, and you know, a lot of those, a lot of those directors who really, you know, really worked in that that story. And then, you know, you're talking, Chandler actually wrote a lot of those screenplays. And that's an interesting thing about film noir is like, is the, it's how tightly it is tied to its literary sources.
You know, it, it's funny that when we do these lists, we find often like when we're working within a genre that we find a lot of the same names coming up. You know, like when I said, like when we did Crime and Gangster, the Coens kept coming up, and when we did fucking sci-fi, I think James Cameron came up like 6 out of 10 times. But yeah, it's a. This is a fantastic movie genre that I cannot stress enough how much
and,
I love
and
it.
It is one that I am sadly
underexposed
to.
Yeah. You, if you want to see one that's not a, a particularly great movie, but it's it, but it's really it's pretty good and there's a lot of good stuff in it. It's called The Dark Corner, and I'm gonna look it up on IMDb because I only know one person who's in it. But the reason it's worth watching is it's a young, hot Lucille Ball. Lucille Ball, in 1946, there you go. Lucille Ball, director Henry Hathaway, Clifton Webb, and William Bendix. Clifton Webb is the detective. William Bendix is the bad guy.
Right on.
Yep. Lucille Ball is the scrappy, innuendo-slinging secretary, and she just, every time the camera moves to her, you just feel like, oh, this is the only living being on a planet of robots. I mean, she just is a giant goddamn movie star and television star in this thing, and it's worth hunting down. I don't know if it's streaming or not. I think it is. It's kind of a straight by the numbers PI film noir PI movie, but it's worth seeing it just as a little hidden lost gem for her performance.
Cool. No, I mean, I you know what? I'm probably gonna watch everything that I haven't seen from your list because it sounds like you know your shit. Yeah.
One of the things I love about doing this is I get to add several movies to the list that I want to see now. So
it gets to be intimidating sometimes. Yes. Like when we did, who did we do pre-Star Wars sci-fi? I think I had to watch like 10 movies because of that goddamn list.
Yes.
Well, all right. You know what? I'll give you. You've seen Fargo because you've seen all the.
Oh, I love those.
Okay. I'll give you three that I don't know if you've seen. Okay, or maybe four. All right. If you're just adding, if we're adding Netflix cues tonight. Soderbergh's The Limey, which I'm sure you saw.
Oh, yeah.
I love that movie.
We're in love with that movie.
And Soderbergh originally did a noir right before that. I can't remember the year. I'm going to say it's 96 or something or 94 called The Underneath, which was a remake.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was a remake of Criss Cross. I think it was. This is a great noir. Not quite as successful. The Limey is magnificent. The Limey is just work of art.
I love Terrence Stamp, and everyone needs to see The Limey. Yeah. It's fantastic.
My name's right. Well, sir.
Better Luck Tomorrow by Justin Lin, who we were talking about.
Yeah,
that is a good movie.
Justin Lin, that was his breakthrough, and it is a great cultural noir, you know, really exploring the world. We all saw Brick, right? We're all Joseph Gordon-Levitt fans, so you all saw Brick.
Yep.
Hard Eight.
Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah. That is a fucking flick.
Paul Thomas Anderson's first film. Nobody ever knows that.
That movie is fucking awesome. I love Paul Thomas Anderson.
I know. And that movie, because he's gone on and done artier and bigger stuff, it's got...
what one was I looking
at? I'm blanking. It's got...
Dark Corner.
Hold on. Let's look it up.
Aaron was checking to see if the Dark Corner... Yeah. It's not an instant stream. Dark Corner's not on instant stream right now.
They must have pulled it. Heart 8. There you go. Also known as Sydney. It has got a young John C. Reilly in it. I knew it. I knew John C. Reilly was in it. Got Samuel L. Jackson, Gwyneth Paltrow. It's, what a movie.
Mm-hmm. Wow, look how skinny he is. Oh, Jimmy. Yeah. Sam.
Buddy, it was 90 something. We were all a lot skinnier back then.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Very good one. Now we got some movies to be watching, dude.
Oh, we do, yes.
That sucks.
We have to take a break from organizing a con.
Yeah.
And watch a movie or two.
There you go. Okay, well, I guess stay tuned. We're going to be right back with our outro section.
more blues. I can win, but I sure can lose. I don't remember just what you said. I only know that you said it in bed. God damn it, honey, what am I to think? Guess I'll just sit around you and drink. There's only one thing I can do. I have to do it, baby. I have to see it through. I'm gonna stop.
We are back. We just had a fantastical discussion about film noir, and I think that if we didn't put the brakes on it, we'd probably keep going until the wee hours of the morning. But it was a great discussion with Mr. John Rogers. Thank you very much for being on tonight, John. Thanks for having me on, guys.
I love talking about this stuff. And you know, this is, to me, this is the promise of the internet is, you know, you get to talk to people you would ordinarily never meet. You talk about the stuff you love. So anytime.
Yep. Oh, yeah. When we started our format change back on, what was it, 45?
Yeah, no. Well, 44.
44,
well,
45.
It was technically 45 because 44 was the Empire Strikes Back commentary.
Yes. So, John, you were the first guy I thought of that we needed to get on the show. So.
Oh, thanks, man.
It's great to get other people on here that love movies as much, if not more, than we do.
Yeah, we do love some movies. We always give people an opportunity, our guests, whenever they come on here, to pimp anything they would like to do. What do you have in the pipelines? What projects do you have working on that you'd like people to check out, John?
Let's see. I'm writing the Dungeons & Dragons comic book for IDW, which is a lot of fun. It was a real challenge because, you know, they were launching it. They were launching the comic, and they were looking for somebody who would not come in and do, you know, these and therefores and thous and Wheel of Time magical stuff. So Denton contacted me, the editor who I torment on a regular basis with my late scripts, and he said, do you want to take a run at this? And so I did. I do the book. The book is basically a pulp book. It is, you know, people fight with swords, crazy shit happens, they get into trouble, they get out of trouble. And the dialogue is all meant to be very current. It's meant to be like the best Dungeons & Dragons game you've ever played in. And, you know, it's been very well received. People were really looking forward to that different voice. Because I haven't been doing a lot of promo because of leverage, I haven't done a lot of interviews and press for it. But so I want to take this opportunity. I'm very proud of the book. The artist is fantastic. And you have a chance. The first collection has just been is in pre-order now, the first 5 issues. And you can definitely get all the back issues kicking around comic shops. But that's my big thing right now. Besides, of course, the television show I run. But that is the horrible fucked up thing about me. I will promote my comic book over my television show.
Hey, it probably needs ink a little bit more than the TV.
Incidentally, are you going to be able to make it to Gen Con this year?
I don't know. When is Gen Con this year?
First weekend in August.
No, not gonna make it.
Shoot
finale. Yeah, nope, I'm gonna be busy. I never make Gen Con, man. It just breaks my heart. Every year I'm shooting the finale to my television show. It just sucks.
It's
literally just the weekend I can't get away. Yeah, I didn't get to go to Comic Con last year, and I might manage to actually escape this year for Comic Con.
Cool.
But I won't be going to the con. I'm actually going to just go and find a bar near the con and pay the guy like $1,000 to let me sit there for all weekend and run a tab. If you want to come see me, because I'm not going in that goddamn hall again this year.
I'm fucking there. That's all there is.
Totally.
I'm going all the way there to drink.
I go there. I just go there to meet my friends I stay in touch with internationally anyway. Uh-huh. So, I mean, you know, I just go there for the bar, so why not make the whole thing the bar?
Yeah, good point.
The Leverage premieres June 26th, fourth season, big season, a lot of new writers, a lot of new exciting stuff on the show. You know, the show's really, really in a great place right now. We're doing cool stuff. And the Dungeons & Dragons comic book, and, you know, eventually this book about film noir, but not anytime soon because, you know, I got a day job.
Yeah, those always suck, don't they? Okay,
mine's pretty good. Not going to lie to you.
Is it? Well, good. mine's being a student, which is fun in its own weird
way. I remember that. That was pretty good back in the day.
Weird in its own weird way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So we're not going to be on next week, huh, Ethan?
We're not going to be on next week.
Okay. So when are we going to be back on?
We're going to be back on in 2 weeks when we're going to be joined by Mr. James Lowder, who's an author, who's going to be talking with us about classic horror.
Sweet. Do we have any dates set up for that, or classic?
No, not really.
Okay.
What do you consider classic horror?
Frankenstein. I don't know. Go. Okay.
You just ruined your whole list.
Fuck. All right. So I can't put Frankenstein on there.
Nope.
Son of a bitch. Well, that'll be fun. We did horror, I think it was issue 46 or something like that.
Sounds right, yeah.
And we hadn't quite got the ball rolling yet, figuring out how these discussions going. It'll be fun to hit it again, because I think that might be one of our shows that maybe lacked a little bit in enthusiasm, but we have also talked a lot about horror on this show before as well. So that will be fun. That'll be cool. But yeah, so that'll be 2 weeks from tonight. We're gonna have a sabbatical next week, and
My fiance has got family coming in from out of town, so we've got other things happening.
Groovy. I'm just gonna be drinking juice. So I don't have anything else unless you do.
Nope, I think I'm good.
John, you good?
I'm good. Thanks a lot for having me on, guys.
Well, it's been a blast. Well, until 2 weeks from now, I'm Aaron.
I'm Ethan.
Let your geek flag fly.